You're listening to Tune FM, and my name is James Boyce. On the 9th of April, I had a telephone interview with the Honourable Tony Windsor about how he sees Australian politics and country issues in general. This is how it went. Mr. Windsor, could you give us a bit of biographical information about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to university?
Well, I was born in New England. I've lived most of my life in New England, other than some time that I've spent overseas, but I was actually born in Quirindi Hospital.
Oh, okay.
I've resided near Werris Creek. My family came to a property between Quirindi and Werris Creek in 1954. I was 4 years old. My father was subsequently killed in a tractor accident in 1959, and from there on my mother actually ran our property, three boys, and to educate, etc. So, and she's still alive today. Actually, she's 95. But I went to school at Werris Creek Public School and Farrer High School. I boarded at Farrer, just out of Tamworth, and then did a degree in economics at the University of New England.
Oh, fantastic! And we noticed that you were on campus yesterday for a forum. Has very much changed since you were here?
Well, it has. Some of the, you know, the landscape is still the same, but there's a lot more buildings, of course. You know, we were only reflecting on it yesterday, how beautiful the landscape is in terms of the, you know, particularly where the colleges are. I was in Wright College. Mm-hmm. I actually ran the shop in Wright College for a couple of years, and then I lived in town for 1 year as well. So I had a great time at Armidale. You know, still some of my best mates from those years, and I'm sure the students that are there now will form the same.
And does your mother still live locally?
She's in a nursing home now in Quirindi, but still very much aware of what's going on.
Cool. Okay. So what brought you to the university yesterday? What were you here for?
Well, I was invited to a conference on coal seam gas and the implications that that has in terms of, you know, state and federal policy, groundwater issues, just the general concerns a lot of people have about coal seam gas and what it could mean.
Could you explain some of those to us? We've heard a lot about coal seam gas as a title in the news and various things, but I don't think very many people actually sat down and explained what it is, why it's important. Could you give us some information about, you know, how that sort of system works?
Well, in a snapshot, what gas companies do and are trying to do in some areas of New South Wales at the moment is extract methane gas from coal seams. And to do that, they've actually got to drill holes, you know, up to a kilometre deep, and they go through a whole range of geological structure, of course, and quite possibly through a whole range of groundwater aquifers.
Okay.
Some of which might be freshwater, some of which might be saltwater.
Right.
When they find a coal seam, rather than dig it out like a coal miner does, they actually put water down the hole and pressurise the coal seam itself.
Mm-hmm.
And what that pressurising does, and then they depressurise it a bit later, I'm not an absolute expert on this, but it essentially allows the gas to come out of the coal seam and go to the surface. So you end up with water left over. What you do with that water, is it a problem? It could be. What the hole actually does in terms of the potential to mix different groundwater systems, because you've drilled through a whole profile. So they're the concerns that people have in terms of that particular activity. And if something does go wrong with some of the groundwater systems, what does it mean downstream from that system? Because our groundwater is very important, not just in terms of people who want to irrigate from it or give the cow a drink.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important in terms of the replenishment of our river system. So if you have a catastrophe in our groundwater caused by methane extraction, what impact does it have to others is nowhere near the site of the activity. And
so what sort of
concerns that people need answered.
So what sort of protections are there at the moment? What sort would you like to see, or would you like to see loosened, or how is this currently being discussed by the government?
Well, at the Commonwealth level, there's been a degree of dissatisfaction with the state governments This is essentially a state jurisdiction, but there's been continual pressure, and I must admit that I've been applying some of that for the Commonwealth to get involved in this issue, because it's we believe that the state, New South Wales in this case, hasn't put in place enough safeguards. So the policy arrangements that are currently at the state level are flawed. The process should be based on science and risk rather than the need for Barry O'Farrell or who was in government at the time to obtain revenue royalties from these people. We've got to make sure that when these companies carry out these activities, that they don't leave a legacy that's long-lasting for the people who live in those regions.
Is that a state issue or is that a Commonwealth issue primarily?
Well, essentially, it's a state issue. The Commonwealth, and I was instrumental in passing this in amendment only a few weeks ago in the lower house, the Commonwealth is moving into that space and should do so, in my view. That's got through the lower house now. It hasn't been through the Senate yet, and when the Parliament returns, hopefully on day one, it will go through the Senate. And then the Commonwealth will have some say in terms of determining whether these things go ahead, based on independent scientific advice, bioregional assessment of catchments, and not based on the development application process that the states have now. So that will be a big step forward. Some of the gas companies don't like it, of course, because they'd rather just let it rip. But I think we've got to make sure that we don't leave a legacy of disaster behind some of these companies. Let's get it right before we allow it to occur.
While we're talking about these sorts of environmental issues, we've had a lot of talk recently about the mining tax and the carbon tax. Can you give us a little bit of context on how those work in relation to this and whether or not they're any good, you know, what sort of things they are? Can you talk a little bit about those sort of things as well?
Well, the Minerals Rent Resource Tax, in short, what it is a super profits tax. It's the resources of the nation are owned by the nation, the people. They're not owned by particular companies. Particular companies, most of which are international, will take out exploration licenses over particular areas to see if there's anything worth getting out of those areas for them. Once they do that, in some cases they pay state royalties to government to give the community some recompense for using the community's resource and making profits from it. The Commonwealth government, and I actually agree with this personally, the Commonwealth government decided where super profits were being made, you know, absolute, you know, outlandish profits were being made, that a minerals rent resource tax be imposed so that there be some recompense back to the community of those super profits.
So that's not on every mining company. It's just the ones that are making outrageous profits, I suppose.
We get into fabulously wealthy and all those sorts of things. But it's essentially on abnormal profits.
Okay.
And there's been a lot in the news lately that the Minerals Rent Resource Tax has failed and hasn't raised any money. When you actually examine the books of the mining companies, that in the last 12 months they haven't made fabulously wealthy profits. I mean, in a technical sense, they probably shouldn't be paying it. There has been some paid, and in the future, there will be quite a lot paid when super profits are being made. It's a way of redistributing, you know, some of the wealth that's being gained from the resources that we all own, not just those who happen to work there or shareholders of those particular companies. So that's the Minerals Rent Resource Tax, and it's based on profit rather than volume, because a royalty, which the states charge, is based on every tonne that you pull out of the ground, irrespective of whether you're making a profit or not. So the companies themselves would rather have a profit-based tax than a quantity-based tax that's not based on profit.
So its purpose isn't so much to run an environmental challenge or to help rejuvenate. I assume the money would be helped used to rejuvenate the environment, but the purpose of that is more to return some of the money back to the Australian people from these extreme profits.
Yes, right. That's exactly it. Some of that money has gone into this independent scientific committee that I'm talking about that will have some impact on the environment in terms of large coal mining and coal seam gas issues. Now, the carbon tax is a very different kettle of fish again. It's essentially trying to use a market mechanism, a price, in this case a fixed price, to actually drive community change. And in fact, despite all the hoo-ha that went on in relation to this from Tony Abbott and others, that change is occurring within our community as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
Within the first 6 months of the so-called carbon tax, there has been a reduction in emissions. There has been a reduction in energy usage. So the pricing, the price signal is actually starting to have some impact. Now, there's been a lot of talk, and I'm sure a lot of the people listening to this would have heard the politics about Julia Gillard saying there will be no carbon tax in a government I lead.
Yeah, this isn't technically a carbon tax, is it? This is an emissions trading scheme. This is Tune FM. You're listening to James Boyce and Tony Windsor.
No. The way in which this actually works, when you set up a pricing mechanism on carbon, forget whether it's a tax or emissions trading scheme for the moment, to get the institutional framework of that going, you need to strike a fixed price. And John Howard was going to do this when he was talking about it. Malcolm Turnbull was going to do it. They would have had a fixed price for a certain period of time and then converted it into an internationally linked emissions trading scheme. Now, there's a difference between the two things. If it's a fixed price, in Australia's case, it's $23, I think, at the moment, per tonne of carbon emissions. If it's a fixed price, in a technical economic sense, it is known as a tax. If it's an emissions trading scheme, and even though the price might be exactly the same, it's not a tax. So in Julia Gillard's case, and it's not my job to defend her, but I can understand how she's got herself into this pickle. In what she was saying before the election was that essentially if they put a price on carbon, they would have an emissions trading scheme. And that's exactly what they're going to have, but it's going to take a few years to get from the fixed price, the tax, to the emissions trading scheme. So if she'd had a majority government, she wouldn't have had a tax other than for that short period of time you need to get the institutional framework in place. She would have had an emissions trading scheme possibly even by now. So all this hoo-ha about, oh, she lied, she did this, she did that. It's a demonstration that in a minority government, even though the government of the day or the Prime Minister of the day might like to do things, it's up to the majority of the Parliament to determine what happens. And in my case, and Rob Oakeshott's case, in the formation of the Hung Parliament, we wanted something done on carbon pricing, and the Greens were also involved in this. And the scenario that's developed out of that is a fixed price or a tax for a few years before it becomes an emissions trading scheme.
So in reality, the big debate about whether or not Ms Gillard lied about a tax or not comes down to a small term of language. In reality, there will be a trading scheme, but because of how it's been implemented for the next 3 or 4 years, it's technically a tax.
Yeah, what she wanted and what John Howard, Malcolm Turnbull, Tony Abbott, everybody talked about for the last 4 or 5 years, other than this period of time in the Hung Parliament, was that there was going to be a price on carbon. Putting a price on carbon was the cheapest way of achieving a change in the use of energy and reducing emissions. So there was always going to be a price on carbon. There's two ways of achieving that. You can call it a fixed price, and if you do, you can be, in economic terms, it's a tax. If you call it a floating price, an emissions trading scheme, the price can go up and down. It is not a fixed price, therefore it is not a tax. But the price mechanism is the important thing, irrespective of which one you choose. It's putting a price to make changes to society, and it is the cheapest way of doing it.
It's a temporary tax to create a market.
That's it.
Okay. This is an interview with Mr. Tony Windsor, the Member of Parliament for New England, and James Boyce. Now, you mentioned before about the hung parliament and such. I'd like to turn to that a little bit, if I could. Can you firstly give us an actual description of how you see Australia's government type? A couple of years ago, I was studying at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, and while I was there, a lot of people would tell me that we had a benign form of dictatorship where Her Majesty, because of her reserve powers, was able to hold the Australian government and do whatever she liked with it, but she chose not to do that. We officially call ourselves a constitutional monarchy. Some people say that's a democracy. Others say that it's a representative government. Could you give us an understanding of how our government system like that works? Do you, as a member of parliament, represent the New England area? Do you represent the people of Australia? Can you give us your understanding, being inside, on how that works?
Well, I don't think we're a benign a dictatorship. We are a constitutional monarchy in a technical sense, but in a practical sense, we have a system of representation from 150 electorates across Australia. Governments are formed in a majority sense. This particular parliament, you know, very interesting as it is a minority government that was given the numbers by a number of crossbenchers to help it form a majority. So we're a representational democracy. My job as a member, one of 150 members of parliament, is to represent the area of New England. That's not to say you don't have any say in other issues that don't impact on New England. Obviously, you do in a representational democracy. And in a hung parliament, some would suggest that you have more say than you would normally have in a majority parliament. So I think this parliament's been extraordinarily interesting. One of the reasons being that the executive of government, which normally has enormous power, has had some of that power diminished and returned to the actual representatives of the House of Representatives for adjudication.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the issues, and Tony Abbott, as opposition leader, has used this for his political advantage, one of the issues that people tend to look at is that they still, you know, and a lot in the press do, they still look at this particular parliament through the eyes of the government having a majority. It doesn't. And even something like the media laws, where there was a lot of hoo-ha about recently,
mm-hmm.
It was our representational democratic system actually working. The decisions weren't being made by the executive and then imposed on the parliament. They were actually being adjudicated on the floor of the House. And as it turned out, the government didn't like that outcome. But that's what the majority of people on the floor of the House thought was the best outcome.
So would you say a minority government, a minority executive, is a more democratic or a better representation of the people than a majority government?
Well, being an independent, I probably would. But I think this particular parliament, I've been in a number of parliaments. I was in the state parliament in New South Wales for 10 years. This parliament has had the best committee system that I have seen. And it's been painted in the media as being, you know, in chaos and whatever. But the committee system's worked very effectively, the reason being that neither side of Parliament has had control of the committees by way of numbers. So the committees can actually deliberate real issues and make real recommendations and have real participation rather than, as happens normally in a majority Parliament, is that one side will know that they have the numbers and they can determine the outcomes of the recommendations. So it's been a breath of fresh air in terms of doing that. I think there's been a number of other areas where it's been very positive. This parliament has looked at some very long-term issues. And as long as I've been in parliament, the community is always saying to me, look, we want you blokes to go down there and sort all this out and do things for the long term of the nation. Some of us have become a little bit short-term in our thinking, I think, over time, and that might reflect some people in the community as well. But a lot of people do want issues like the Murray-Darling system worked out.
Mm.
A long-term sustainability, all of those, all the rhetoric. A lot of people do want the climate change issue and renewable energy issues addressed. The benefits won't come to us, they won't come to me, they won't come to you in the short term. but they may come to future generations of our own people.
So can you talk us a little bit about the actual agreement and the nature and how that came about when you and the other independents and the Green, the Greens member, gave the majority or the active majority to the Labor government? Every school child in year six is taught about how supply bills work and systems like that, and anybody who remembers 1975 will know that the big debate was over supply. Was the discussions that you made with the Labor government simply to secure that they could pass budget bills, or was there more to it? Can you talk a little bit about that?
You're listening to Tune FM.
Well, because there wasn't a clear majority between the Liberal Party and the Labor Party in the way in which the Australian electorate cast their vote, we ended up with a hung parliament. I think the Labor Party had 71, the coalition had 71, and then
four independents and a Green, if I remember.
It must be 72, 72 and 6.
That sounds right.
I'm a bit rusty on the numbers, but the important thing is that no one had 75 or 6 votes to have an absolute majority. There was a 17-day period where there were a whole range of negotiations that took place to determine, was anybody interested in the Labor Party or the Liberal Party in actually forming a minority government? Both Tony Abbott and Julia Gillard said yes, they were. The third option, of course, was that that there be no minority parliament formed, and that it went back to the people, which would have meant that the people may have voted exactly the same and end up with the same deadlock, in a sense. So the independents were asked to make a decision as to whether which one of the two contenders was the most likely to provide an opportunity for the parliament to serve out its full 3 years, which the Australian people had voted on. We choose, Rob Oakeshott and I choose, and it was our numbers in the end that were the determining numbers. We chose Julia Gillard to do that. And in hindsight, I think we made the right call, because I think Tony Abbott would not have participated in a three-year parliament. He would have waited till Barry O'Farrell won the state election and then found a reason to dismantle parliament. So in that sense, serving out the 3 years, I think this current government will in fact do that. Now, in making that decision, there were a whole range of things, and some people think it was, in my case, based on some sort of philosophical reason. There is virtually no philosophical difference between the Liberal Party and the Labor Party now. When people talk about it, they refer back to the 70s and 80s when the unions were doing this, that and the other, and big business was doing something else.
The watchword around campus is that they are two sides of the same party.
Well, they are. They're two management teams now. They are. They're both Liberal parties. They're two management teams that are vying for power. So I've always argued that country people, through their, if they voted a bit more strategically, could have much more impact on the outcome of policy than they have in the past. And if you look at our political history, for instance, there hasn't been a parliament since Federation where a country member hasn't held the balance of power. It's just in most cases those country members have been either subsumed into the National, or what used to be the Country Party, which was in coalition with the Liberal Party, a city-based party, or in the Labor Party's case, the Country Labor People was subsumed into a city-based Labor Party. So when people say, oh, this is a bit of an aberration for regional Australia, it could in fact be the norm. If the National Party in particular, but other country members, weren't tied to the city-based political party. So I think there's some real historical lessons to be learnt by this particular parliament, and not the least of which is the power that country people can have over their own destiny and the destiny of policy, if in fact they use their vote much more strategically.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you were a member of the Country Party, or was it the National Party, many, many years ago?
I was a card-carrying member of the National Party back in the 1980s. I've never been in any parliament as anything else other than an independent.
Okay, so do you think the option for the Country Party and for the people of for the benefit of Australia is that the National Party should perhaps separate and reform into a country party that can run its own majority, or perhaps Bob Katter's idea of setting up a new party is a viable alternative to the two management styles, as you say, of what we have today? What do you see as the option to bring Australia into a position where we can have actual policy debates?
Well, if you look at the Western Australian state arrangement, I think it comes as close to doing the correct thing. They've just had another election now, but the previous state parliament was a hung parliament in itself. The National Party of Western Australia, headed up by a bloke called Brendan Grylls, actually decided to negotiate with the Liberal Party and the Labor Party, and he very nearly went with the Labor Party. But in his negotiations, he was able to get benefits for regional Western Australia, and just bear in mind that nearly 80% of Western Australians live in Perth now, so it's an atrocity happening. He was able to get benefits to go back into regional Western Australia and not be tied to one side of Parliament. So I think that's where the National Party should be in their representation of country people. They shouldn't be tied to one side of Parliament, because what happens, you automatically get taken for granted by both sides, particularly where there are safe seats. And as soon as you have a safe seat, whether it be safe Labor or safe National, it gets ignored in the debate. Loyalty is not rewarded in politics. People think it is. Oh, I'll always vote for them because they always look after me. History says that the opposite to that. They don't necessarily look after you. They take you for granted. And I think in the coming election in New England, I think people have got to really think about those things. Some people are suggesting, oh, we've got to get back into bed with the National Party. Well, have a think about how it operated when you were there and the degree of focus that was on this particular electorate. The answer is virtually nil.
I agree with you that safe seats are the seats that are forgotten. My seat of Shortland back in Newcastle, and the number of Newcastle seats which are all safe Labor seats don't get a lot of things for them, and we've had problems with infrastructure for quite a while. But in that context then, can you tell us, are you going to run for the re-election this time around?
Oh, yes, yeah. If I'm alive and well and haven't been assassinated, I'll be running. No, as long as my family's well, of course. I was in another parliament, well, in the federal parliament, when a good friend of mine, an independent from Orange, Peter Andren, was going to run in the Senate. And he contracted cancer and died before the election was held. So you can never... I've never presumed the seat of New England, and I'm always reluctant to say, oh, yes, I'll be running next time. You're elected for the term that you're in, and you shouldn't presume that there's always going to be a next time. That was the problem with the National Party. They just assumed they owned it. They don't. The people own it. I don't. The people own it. And so I'm always a bit reluctant to say, oh, yes, there's always gets asked of me, you're going to run next time, or... Yeah, when you say, no, I'm not going to run next time, does that mean it gets interpreted that you're giving up on the people that you're representing? So I'll be there if I'm alive and well.
Okay, that's fantastic. And speaking about the country issues and the country discussions, do you see Australia's identity as being country? Do you see our future as relying on the country and such? Or do you see the bigger cities being more problematic, being more of a heartland for Australia?
Well, we're tending to be...
I suppose it's a biased question because you're a country boy and a country member.
Oh, thank you for that. We tend to be a bit of a city and coastal nation because of a relatively arid inland to a certain extent, particularly the very centre. I think one of the things, and it was one of the issues that made me decide to support Julia Gillard rather than Tony Abbott, And this very day, we're going to see some changes made by Malcolm Turnbull. The National Broadband Network, Armidale has been right at the forefront of that. The University of New England has been excellent. The Armidale Council has been excellent. it has the capacity to really change the dynamics of where people live. There's been this sort of feedlot mentality that's been developed in Australia over the years, that if you're not in the big cities, you don't get access to this, that, and the other thing. And if you live in the cities, you'll get it at the lowest possible cost. The rollout of the national broadband network and particularly the fibre will in fact change the dynamics of that, where it will be cheaper to run a business from the country. It removes the disadvantages of distance, remoteness, smallness, you know, scale. All of those issues are diminished by having access, particularly at the same wholesale prices that Oakeshott and I were able to get from the government. It gives country people a real advantage. I have never seen a piece of infrastructure that has so much advantage in it for country people. And it just annoys me to see many country representatives of Parliament actually arguing against it and saying, we'll do it cheaper, but you'll get a second-hand version of the same thing. I think what we want to do as a nation is aim for the Rolls-Royce on this. It puts us in a better global position as well. It puts country people in an excellent position, whether it be in relation to accessing health, education, or business opportunities. And I'll just give you an example, James, of one of the things I've been rattling on about for quite some time. We're going to have, in the aged care area, we're going to have the sort of baby boomer group go through the system in the next 15 to 20 years.
Mm.
When that occurs, we're going to have enormous demands made for capital infrastructure and operational care of a lot more people than we've got now in the aged care system. So there's going to be an enormous drag on the budget. If through having fibre to the home, not to the node, if through having fibre to the home, we are able to keep, I've used the example, 100,000 aged people in their home for one extra year, for instance, or maybe two extra years, because they can have real-time monitoring of their health, they can have real-time monitoring of their kettle, their microwave, the radiator, they can be in real-time contact with their loved ones or their doctor or their pharmacist or whatever else. Having that e-security blanket, in a sense, to give people a little bit more security to be on their own in their own home, what does that mean economically for the nation? Just forget about the social benefits for the person. For the moment, it is enormous. It is billions and billions of dollars, if in fact you can create that sort of mechanism. Because what it means is you wouldn't have to build as many aged care facilities for as many people, so there'd be savings in a capital sense, and also the operational sense of, it costs up to $130, $140 a day to have someone in an aged care facility. So by putting fibre to the home, it gives everybody the opportunity, whether they're rich or they're poor, to access those sorts of real-time facilities. They can be in instantaneous contact with their relatives in Melbourne, if they live in Armidale. Their health can be being monitored, and red lights can go off if something starts to show up. All of that can be done through this the NBN. So I'll be arguing very strongly that what I think Malcolm Turnbull's going to do a bit later today, weakening that particular arrangement, I'll be arguing very, very strongly against it, because I think
that arrangement being the Liberal Party's plan to put fibre to the node and not to the home, right?
Yes. He'll argue that he can do it a lot cheaper. What he's doing is second best, and not good enough. And just that one example of aged care nearly blows the economics of what Turnbull will be on about, in terms of you've got to cut back on this thing. He's arguing that you should only have fibre to the home if, in fact, you're running some sort of business where you need high-capacity broadband.
You're listening to TuneFM.
I suppose in that context, being university students here for the most part, does that mean that being my sister, for example, is about to graduate as a teacher, a secondary teacher, is going to the country, getting a job in the country where this sort of connection to home, family, the internet in general, to be able to. Now Australian businesses are starting to take up the internet as an option for their sales platforms. Does that make the country a much better, a much more attractive option for graduates and such? And is there the infrastructure out there, or do we have to do more to put our graduates out there?
Well, I think a bit of both is happening. There's no doubt that if people can see that they're going to be have access to the same technology as their city cousins, they are more likely to be attracted to the country. In terms of the business bottom line of operating a business, fibre, broadband will give you an advantage of location, because it'll be cheaper to live in Armidale than it will be to live in Sydney. And if you can get the same wholesale price, well, that's great.
I've lived in both, and I can tell you that's absolutely true as well, sir.
Oh, well, you've lived that life. I don't think people fully comprehend what the Rolls-Royce system actually means, potentially, particularly for country people. What I'm worried about as a representative is that everybody will get some sort of broadband mechanism under the coalition if there's a change of government, and there probably will be. But will country people revert to that second-class status that they've always had? You know, they had it with Telstra, they had it with mobile towers, mobile phones, all of that stuff. You know, we don't need to go there. And there's plenty of examples, and many of which we don't even know yet. They haven't even been invented for the use of fibre optic cable. You know, the exponentiality of the load, the capacity of it, is just extraordinary. And we mightn't think that that's important now, but what will we think in 10 years' time? Mm. And how will we compare if our city cousins have got the exponentiality of it and we've got a half-closed gate? Well, it gets us back into the same environment as we once were in, where we're second-class citizens again. And then there'll be the push to go, where do you go if you want to be up with the speed? Well, you've got to go to the city, pal. And that means, you know, evacuation of people from our areas. This is the dynamic that can change all that. It's the paradigm shift that we've been looking for. And politically, I would hope that all country people would actually support it.
So in the context of the election that's coming up that Mrs. Gillard has called, and Ms. Gillard has called, I'm being waved off for time, but you mentioned before that Malcolm Turnbull is starting to push a few of the Liberal Party's buttons and such. If you were to get the balance of power again, if we were to have another hung parliament, knowing what you've known now with your experience, would you make the same decision? Would you side with Labor over the Liberal Party? Would you prefer to see Malcolm Turnbull take over the leadership, or Kevin Rudd of the Labor Party? What sort of advice can you give to the Australian people about what they should be looking for, and how you, in your experience, would like to see changes happen?
Well, it's very difficult to talk about hypotheticals. I don't think there will be a hung parliament next time. If there was, I'd go through the same process, look at the major issues, and look at the major players. A lot of the choice last time was based on issues. One was the NBN. If Malcolm Turnbull had been the leader of the Liberal Party last time, he may well have been the Prime Minister today, because he's a different kettle of fish altogether. But even given what I've just said in terms of his attitude to the National Broadband Network, and obviously if that circumstance came along and there was a hung parliament and Oakeshott and I were in a similar position and Malcolm Turnbull was the leader of the Liberal Party, which is all very hypothetical, but if that was the case, one of the conditions on the formation of government, and some of these were imposed on Julia Gillard, one of the conditions may well be that you don't touch the fibre optic, you don't touch NBN, you get it right, and you give people, country people, that degree of advantage by making sure that they get the system and the service. And so that's the power of a hung parliament, in a sense, is that irrespective of what they say they might do, and here again, the Julia Gillard's carbon tax promise, what they say they might do, when a hung parliament comes along, they have to deal with others who aren't on the executive and aren't in their party. So they can suddenly change their mind on some of the issues that they may well have gone to the polls on.
Okay. One last question before we run out of time. Can you explain to us, there's a lot of discussion here about what actually happened with Mr. Torbay. I don't know if you can talk about this, and I'll be glad to cut down to the end of the interview as well, but if you can't talk about it. But all we know is that Mr. Torbay suddenly resigned from everything, and then the Australian Federal Police raided the offices here. Can you talk about what happened with that situation at all?
No, well, I don't have a problem talking about it, but I don't know what I'll be talking about because I don't know what's actually happened. But what I would say to people, and I think it's common knowledge, I wasn't terribly happy with Richard Torbay. You know, he'd been a colleague of mine as an independent for many years, suddenly joining the Nationals to try and unseat me. So I thought that was a bit disingenuous and opportunistic. But having said that, Richard Torbay hasn't been found guilty of anything.
No.
Now, I've been criticised at the federal level for not condemning and killing off, in a sense, Craig Thompson. There's various allegations about him. Peter Slipper, there's been allegations about him, some of which have been disproved and just found to be political innuendo. I've argued that those people have the right of the presumption of innocence until proven guilty of whatever it may be. Now, in Richard's case, I don't know whatever it may be that he's being the ICAC is looking at, but I think people have got to give him the benefit of the doubt until some proof is made in about any allegation. And so I'd treat Richard in the same way as I would Peter Slipper and Craig Thompson. They are innocent until proven guilty, and there's been plenty of circumstances. I saw Nick Greiner back in another hung parliament I was in. He was found guilty of something by the ICAC, went to an appeal, and then found to be not guilty. So I think you've got to allow people the presumption of innocence rather than just assuming they're guilty because the newspaper said so.
Well, speaking about Mr. Thompson and Mr. Slipper, we've seen a lot this year, and this is a personal question. We've seen a lot of very nasty things being said about these guys, a lot of very, the way I would describe it is dirty politics, but it's really disgusting types of politics. Do you think that Australia's politics is getting dirty and it becoming, I suppose, dishonourable is the phrase? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because personally, I'm appalled by some of the stuff that I've seen in Parliament.
No, it is a bad thing. There's no doubt about that, and I'll get criticised for what I'm about to say, but it's Tony Abbott-style politics, and that's why I made the point about Malcolm Turnbull earlier. He has a different style altogether. He doesn't go to the grubbiness and the innuendo and particularly the fear-type politics. Barnaby Joyce has a similar style. One of his key drivers is to create fear in people's minds that you know, the end of the world is coming, doom and gloom.
Like with the carbon tax.
Yeah, to get people frightened so that they don't really address the substantive issues. I think the Australian people need to stand up against some of the vitriol that's been out there. But it's no doubt, in my mind, that it's been driven by Abbott. It was driven in the first place to destroy the Parliament because he thought the Parliament, hung Parliament, wouldn't hang together. He was quite happy to let it hang together if he was the chosen one, and he actually begged for the job, which was, said something about his character as well. But he is now in a circumstance where he hoped it would collapse. It hasn't collapsed, but he can't change his ways in terms of just vomiting on our parliamentary system on as many occasions as he can. Not good. People don't like it. They're blaming everybody. Everybody in politics gets part of the backwash of that sort of thing.
Mm.
One of the great regrets that I have is that Abbott will probably win the next election, and I hope he can be a positive Prime Minister. But what he will see is the Labor Party in the Senate, along with the Greens, giving him massive payback of the same sort of vitriolic, toxic stuff that he's dished out to them, and that's not good for the next decade of politics or representation, irrespective of who's in government.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you very much for your time. Absolute last question. We've heard a lot of discussion that Barnaby Joyce is going to challenge for this seat. Barnaby Joyce was actually a member of Tune FM when he was studying at the University of New England. He ran the metal show. Would you like an opportunity to come back and run your own music show so that you can get some of the local press?
I'm not a great musician, but...
What is your taste in music? We can play something around that.
It'd be pretty boring to a lot of people. I actually like songs that have got a message in them. Graham Connors. Now, I'm not a great country music fan, but I like some of Graham Connors' stuff. A Road Less Travelled, I think, has a bit of a political message. And quite a lot of his stuff is not only interesting to listen to, but it's got something to say. I'm not into heavy metal. I've had children that I have been, and that's why I'm partly deaf now.
Magnificent. Thank you so much for talking to us, Mr. Windsor.
Okay, thanks, James.